Luke 21:1-34 and 22:54-62, the 85th talk in a series entitled The Gospel of Luke, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 30, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to be in Luke chapter 22, when I only have a few weeks left to try to finish the Gospel of Luke. I want to finish it before the end of the year, so I will, I think, keep to a minimum unless the Spirit leads me. I will keep my preaching to a minimum, and I'm just going to explain the passage as best I can. I need to do that to make good enough time to be able to finish this. Just to remind you of the chronology here, excuse me. On a probably Sunday evening, Sunday afternoon, the Sanhedrin gets together and make a final plot to kill Jesus. Jesus somehow knows that that's the case, so he takes his disciples away to a place called Ephraim. We don't know where Ephraim is, but John calls it Ephraim on the edge of the wilderness. He takes them away to Ephraim. They spend Sunday night, all day Monday, Monday night, and most of the day Tuesday hiding out in Ephraim. Tuesday is the Passover. So they return to the city, Jerusalem, at the end of the day in order to eat the Passover dinner, having sent Peter and John ahead to probably offer up the lamb, the Passover lamb, and prepare it for the dinner. They have their Passover meal, so that would be Tuesday evening. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, Tuesday evening. And that's where we are in the events of things. They have just, we looked at last week where Jesus was taking the various elements of the Seder, of the Passover dinner, and was giving a new interpretation to them, a new midrash. Instead of celebrating the Exodus from Egypt, he's encouraging them from now on, whenever they take the Passover, to take the elements of the Passover as a memorial to him and his death, and what that means rather than the Exodus. And that's where we finished last week. Right in the middle of the dinner then, we come to verse 21. And yet, look, the hand of the one who is delivering me over to the authorities is with me at my table. For indeed the Son of Man is going in accord with what has been determined. Yet nevertheless, woe to that man through whom he is being delivered over. This is all Luke has to say about it. John and I think Matthew have a little bit more extensive account of Jesus identifying who it is, or hinting at least, that the very one who's going to betray him, the word that is, I didn't translate it betray, a lot of English translations translate it betray. I'm not exactly sure why they do, because the word seems to me clearly enough to mean to deliver somebody over to authorities, to arrest, to capture. So Judas's deed is to hand Jesus over into the custody of the temple guard. It is a betrayal, certainly, but the word doesn't actually mean betrayal as nearly as I can tell. But the one who is going to hand him over into the custody of the temple guard is with him at the table, he says. Then he makes an interesting comment. For indeed, the Son of Man is going in accord with what has been determined. And what he means is going to his death, going to his crucifixion. So he's going to be crucified just as it has been determined. Now, what does he mean by that? He means by his Father, by the transcendent creator of all of reality. This is what has been predestined from before the foundation of the earth, that he, Jesus, the Son of Man, go to his death by crucifixion at this time. So it's going to happen, just as God determined, but then notice what he says, yet nevertheless, woe to that man through whom he is being delivered over. Here's a classic case of the kind of tension that you find, I think, everywhere in the Bible between the sovereignty of God and what that implies, that God in his sovereignty determines everything on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, there's no sense in the Bible that the fact that God is determining what is occurring removes human responsibility, human accountability, human freedom. Woe to that man through whom he is being delivered over. Everything about the account suggests that Jesus, the other apostles, hold Judas accountable for his action. It is a betrayal. It is an evil. It is a free choice that he made out of greed, cowardice, whatever the motive was. It was a very evil choice that he made in his freedom. So woe to him, Jesus says. On the other hand, it's got to happen. It's going to happen. God has ordained before the foundation of the earth that it happen. The consequences of an act, so an act can be both free and determined at the same time. As is this is a classic case of that. Another way of looking at it is an act can have good consequences at the same time that it is an evil act, which is the case here as well. The act is an evil act by an evil person, but it's the best thing that ever happened in cosmic history, is that Jesus go to the cross on behalf of us. So it's very important in this day and age where we are immersed in a society and a culture that judges actions by their consequences, by their results, that we pay attention to this. An action is not judged by its consequences. It's judged by something else. Judas, the consequences of Judas' act are wonderful. The act itself is evil. Its good consequences don't make it a good act. Okay, then the story shifts. Then they began to inquire among themselves which one of them it might be who was about to do this thing. And an argument broke out among them concerning which one of them seemed to be the greatest. John has a fuller account of this discussion about who it might be. We know from John's account that Jesus actually told some of the disciples who it was that was going to betray him. Luke gives us no indication of that here. He just comments that they began to wonder among themselves and inquire among themselves who it might be. And then he shows that that discussion led to a different kind of dispute. An argument broke out among them concerning which of them seemed to be the greatest. I think it's easy enough to see how that transition got made. Various people would make some nominations as to who it was that was going to betray them. They would overhear the fact that they'd been nominated and protest, I'm loyal, I'm committed, no way am I going to betray him, and in fact, I'm the best disciple of all. You know, I'm the greatest of them all. And then that led to a whole discussion about who in fact among them was the greatest. Jesus then, hearing that, uses that opportunity to teach them a little bit about greatness. And he said to them, this is 25, I think. And he said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who have authority over them are called benefactors. But it is not this way with you, but the one who is the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the servant. For who is greater, the one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as the one who serves. Okay, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, he says, and those who have authority over them are called benefactors. I think because I've been reading a little bit on political theory, I'm reading a book by Jonah Goldberg called Liberal Fascism that's just been very provocative and very interesting, fascinating book. But it just stood out at me because of what I've been thinking about these days. Those who have authority over them are called benefactors. In the ancient world, anybody who had done some kind of magnificent, made some contribution to the state, received the title benefactor, and then typically any actual governing authority also received this title of benefactor. It's an interesting title because it betrays the tendency of human beings The tendency that we have as human beings is to arrogate ourselves to the position of God himself. This was certainly true in the ancient world. We see it clearly if you know anything about the Roman Empire, how ready the emperors were certainly to want to be deified upon their death and have people acknowledge them and worship them as gods. And then I think it was Caligula was the first one who actually gets himself declared a god while he's still alive. And emperor worship was mainstay of the Roman Empire because these emperors believed that they had godlike effects over the people. And what's striking is how things have not changed. I mean, we look at the Roman world and all of that, and it looks so strange and looks so bizarre. But do the campaign promises that our presidents make, are they any different? You know, vote for me, and I will bring you prosperity and security and peace and meaning and hope, and you will be a different person. I'm going to transform our culture and make you an entirely different race of people. Mankind itself will be changed if I'm elected. You know? I mean, incredibly. Now, I think we take it all as a kind of hyperbole, perhaps, but on the other hand, it betrays something that's in the heart of man, I think, is that we don't need God. We don't look to God. We are looking to our government to give us everything that is really only a divine prerogative. Well, so the contrast is very stark here. The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who have authority over them are called benefactors. But it is not this way with you. But the one who's the greatest among you must become like the youngest. And I think by the youngest he means in a society that had such great respect for seniority and age. To be like the youngest is to be someone who had no expectations, that did not have the expectations of receiving the same praise and glory and honor and acknowledgement and respect as the older people do. So basically it's reminiscent of Jesus' comments, "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth." Who are the greatest? The greatest are the meekest. And what does it mean to be meek? To have no sense of entitlement. To have no sense that anyone owes me anything. To just be willing to serve God and look out to see that others get the respect that is due them and that others get the acknowledgement that is due them. But to not worry about me getting the respect that I think is due me. That's meekness. The younger ones are the meeker ones. So the one who's the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the servant. And then rhetorically he asks, who's greater, the dude who's getting served at the table or the guy who's serving him? Well, in our culture, in our mind, in our way of thinking, it's the one who reclines at the table who's the greatest. But Jesus says, but I am among you as the one who serves. I haven't come among you reclining at table expecting you to wait on me, expecting you to serve me, expecting you to give me the status and glory and honor that a great person would expect and would crave and would desire. I've come simply to serve. And he doesn't draw the conclusion from that explicitly, but it's clear the conclusion he wants us to draw, emulate me. Be like I have been among you. You be that way. So this is not a new lesson. He's given this lesson to his disciples once or twice before, but he's just repeating what the true nature of greatness is in among human beings. I think he stays on the theme of greatness just a little bit longer in 25. You are the ones who have still remained committed to me in the midst of my trials. And just as my Father has granted me a kingdom, I grant you that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and you will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. What does he mean? You are the ones who have still remained committed to me in the midst of my trials. I think what he's getting at is that the last month, and especially the last week of Jesus' life here, has been very, very stressful. not only is there the intrigue of the governing authorities out to get Jesus, they've had to go into hiding every night to prevent him from being arrested. They have been constantly surrounded by hostile establishment in the temple during the day, that it could not have escaped the disciples' notice how precarious their situation is, on the one hand. And on the other hand, you don't get it so much in the Gospel of Luke, but in the Gospel of John, man, Jesus' teaching during this last week is really a downer. I'm going to be crucified and arrested, and you guys are going to split, and you're going to leave, and you're going to be threatened, and you're going to be persecuted. I mean, it is not exactly an encouraging sort of message. So during that time, what's a disciple to do? I mean, how much is it going to take before one of these disciples decides, you know, dude, this just ain't worth it. You're not what I thought you were going to be, and this is not going down the way I thought it was going to go down. I'm out of here. I'm not interested. And I think that's what Jesus realizes, is that was a very real possibility for these men. They could have very easily decided, I'm out of here. I'm not interested in this scenario that you're painting for me, and this danger that's all around us. Why do I need to put up with this? Why don't I just go back and be in plain old ordinary Jew like everybody else? But they didn't. And I think Jesus is acknowledging that fact. They have somehow managed to remain committed. They don't know much. They don't really understand it, even though Jesus has been very explicit at times. It just hasn't clicked for them, and they can't put the picture all together. Not yet. That's going to come later. But one thing they do know is this man is so unusual, I believe it when he claims to be the Son of God. He is the Messiah. And they remain committed to that, even though they don't understand it and they don't have clarity on it, and even though it's dangerous and bizarre to them, it's still too true for them to give up on. So they remain faithfully committed to the prospect that Jesus is the Messiah and I want to follow him. So Jesus is acknowledging that here. And I think in this context, I think the significance of him acknowledging that is it's his way of saying that's greatness. It's not our typical way of thinking of greatness, but that's greatness. True heroism, the true hero in human existence, is the one who faces those existential crises where life comes at you and it deals you a hand that just does not look very good. And yet you continue believing and hoping in the life to come as announced by Jesus anyway. That's the hardest thing any human being will ever do. It is absolutely a miracle. It is absolutely bizarre that we still believe what we believe today. And it will be even more bizarre that we will continue believing it into the future when we face the tests that are coming to us. These disciples have been seriously tested. We're going to see another one coming up. These disciples have been seriously tested, but they've gone on believing. It's nothing short of heroic that they have done that. It's nothing short of heroic that you continue believing through all the futility and disappointments and persecution and grief that has come to you because you believe. So, in the light of that greatness and heroism, what does Jesus say? Just as my Father has granted me a kingdom, I grant you that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and you will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Question is, what does that mean? Well, it could be that he's referring to some special kind of honor and status that they are going to have in the age to come, in the eternal kingdom that is to come. I have no problem with that. The only thing that gives me pause about that is unless I may be mistaken, but it would appear to me that Paul's perspective on the age to come is that's a place where there really is no Jew and Gentile in the age to come. So the idea of judging the 12 tribes of Israel as if they have a distinct identity is a little bit problematic to me. It's not impossible, because certainly the sense in which there's no Jew or Gentile in the age to come doesn't have to nullify them having an identity as being members of the tribes of Israel. So that may not be a serious problem, but it gives me pause about that. Another possibility is that what he's talking about is that kingdom in the other sense, the kingdom where Jesus is going to rule over his own people, the Jews, literally the tribes of Israel. That seems more consistent with the notion of judging the 12 tribes of Israel if it's actually the kingdom where God is king, where Jesus is king over the Jewish people per se. When is that going to happen? If I understand my prophecy rightly, it'll happen one of the last things to happen in this created reality. And in that time, Jesus will reign as king, and then he's saying, and you will join me judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, what does that mean? Are they going to come back and be literally present, much like Moses and Elijah came back on the mountain where Jesus was transfigured? Are they literally going to reappear and literally and physically judge over the 12 tribes of Israel? God can do whatever he wants, and if that's what he does, that's fine. I'm inclined to think that this is metaphorical here, because I'm also inclined to think that Jesus' rule over them is not literal and physical, that he will not be physically present, but he will rule over them in the same way that he's ruling over you and I right now. That is, he is our Lord. He is our King. He is the one that we are seeking to serve and seeking to obey. And when this kingdom comes on earth, it will be a whole people group. Everybody in Israel, every last man, woman, and child will have a heart to want to serve their king that they will now acknowledge as Jesus, who will now acknowledge Jesus to be that king. But I think Jesus may rule from a distance, from wherever he is in the cosmos, not literally and physically present. If that's the case, then I would expect that's the same thing of these men as well. They're ruling from a distance. It's not that they are literally judging the 12 tribes of Israel, but they will be acknowledged for their place, their role. They're the ones that passed on the teaching of Jesus to us. How are they judging over the 12 tribes of Israel? We must study their words. We must study their teaching. We must study their instruction and know what it is that they have had to teach us. That may be way too taking it way less literally than it deserves, but if I were betting at this point, I would bet that that's what Jesus means. I have no problem with it being literal. Maybe that's the way it's going to go down instead, but I'm inclined not to think so. Okay, then he shifts to one person in particular in 31. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail, and you, when once you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. Simon, who we know as Peter, he turns to Peter and he says, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat. Shades of Job here. Satan is coming and saying to God, in effect, Peter ain't much. Let me at him and I'll show you. So Satan has demanded that permission. It says to sift you like wheat. I think what that means is to look for chaff in you, basically. To sift like wheat. Typically, they threshed their wheat by throwing it up in the ground on a windy day and letting the wind blow the chaff away. And that would have got rid of most of the chaff. But as the women were baking, they would take the already threshed wheat and put it in these woven sieves in order to finish getting the chaff out of the grain. So that seems to be what he's referring to, sifting you like wheat. So I think he's going to be looking for some chaff in you, Peter. Satan has asked permission to do that. I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail, and you, when once you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. Now, what's interesting is it's true that Peter's faith ultimately does not fail, but Peter's faith doesn't fail after having failed first. So ultimately, Jesus' prayer is answered, but he's severely tested, and tested in a way that at least on the outside, outwardly, Peter's faith fails. But we have to keep in mind what Paul wrote to Timothy: if we are faithless, yet he remains faithful, for he cannot be, whatever, shouldn't have started, I can't finish it. It's a good verse, memorize it. When once you have turned again, notice that he knows he's going to kind of fail. When once you have turned again, when once you've got past your failure and come to terms with it and been restored to your faith, strengthen your brothers. How do we strengthen? How does he strengthen his brothers? How do we strengthen one another? It's an interesting concept that you see coming up over and over again in Paul's writings, that we often call it sometimes translated exhortation. The idea is that I say something, I model something, I appeal to a person, I just seek to get deep enough inside them, to touch them deep enough inside, that they become motivated to do the right thing, to believe what is true, to love what is good and pure, to pursue what is righteous, to serve God. I don't have a switch. I can't make you do that. I don't have access to your will so that I can make a choice for you. You and you alone can make the choice of what you're going to do with your life, and you do that in your freedom. But there is a sense in which one human being can appeal to another in a way that can seek to fortify them to go one direction rather than another, to make one choice rather than another, by instruction, by modeling, by appealing to them. The only thing we shouldn't do is to seek to do it by manipulation, which is unfortunately far too often what we do. Strengthening people is not manipulating them. Strengthening people is to appeal to them straightforwardly with the truth, but in such a way that we touch that that thing inside that motivates them to go in the right direction. Okay, so when you have turned, strengthen your brothers, Peter. But Peter's initial response is a bit of bravado. And this whole passage, several things that we'll see in this passage now, are a striking reminder that it's easy to proclaim loyalty and commitment and dedication. It's another thing to act that way. It's not the same thing to say it. It's a lot harder to do it than to say it. And here's what we see with Peter. But he said to him, "Lord, with you I am ready to go both to prison and to death." And he, Jesus, said, "I say to you, Peter, the rooster will not crow today until you have denied three times that you know me." And he said to them, that's all Peter has to say about that. I'm going to do an audible here. I'm going to skip now over to, because I think I might run out of time, I'm going to deal with Peter's denials here, and then once we've done that, we'll come back to verse 35 of chapter 22. Let's go back to 22:54. This is, we're going to see the Garden of Gethsemane and the arrest of Jesus, and then we come to 22:54, but we'll come back to the Garden of Gethsemane and his arrest later. In 54 it says, "Having arrested him, they led him away and brought him into the house of the high priest." We know from other gospel accounts that that's Caiaphas. "Peter followed from a distance, since they had built a fire in the middle of the courtyard and were all sitting around it. Peter was sitting in the midst of them. Then a certain slave girl, seeing him sitting before the fire and studying him intently, declared with reference to him, "Surely this man was with him." But he denied it, saying, "Woman, I do not know him." After a little while, another person saw him and said, "You are in fact one of them." But Peter said, "Man, I am not." After about 1 hour had passed, another man kept making confident allegations, declaring, "Truth be known, this man was in fact with him, for he is indeed a Galilean." But Peter said, "Man, I don't know what you're talking about." Then immediately while he was speaking, a rooster crowed, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter. Then Peter remembered the declaration of the Lord, just as he had said to him, "Before a rooster crows today, you will deny me 3 times." And he went out and wept bitterly. When you look at all the different gospel accounts of Peter's denials, some people, some skeptics, have concluded that these accounts are so hopelessly irreconcilable that here's proof that the Bible has errors in it, because these accounts cannot all be accurate and cannot all accurately convey what happened here, because there's too much differences between them. Okay, let me go over what I think was the actual historical event. I'm harmonizing all 4 Gospels here. John gives us the most detail about this, and the reason John gives us the most detail about this is he was an eyewitness to all of this. John's family had connections with the aristocracy in Jerusalem. John's gospel tells us that John was known to the high priest, which is really interesting. I mean, I would love to have more information about that. Here's one of the most important of Jesus' disciples who actually is known by the high priest, and that their families know each other. Well, because of that connection, because John knew the high priest, when they take Jesus to Caiaphas for his interview and interrogation and ultimately his trial, John follows them with Peter. They come to the high priest's house, and the servant girl knows John and admits him into the courtyard. So John goes into the courtyard where there's a fire, and a bunch of the officers of the temple are warming themselves, and other servants are warming themselves around the fire in the courtyard. John notices that Peter is not with him, so he goes back out to the gate where Peter has stayed and talks to the servant girl and gets her to allow Peter to come into the courtyard. So they both go back to the fire and start warming themselves around the fire. The servant girl, who has been manning the door then, comes and joins them and begins to study Peter, this stranger that she's led into the courtyard, and says, "You're one of them, aren't you?" To which Peter denies it. And then I'm going to argue that wasn't the only denial around the fire. Other people then join in and pile on and start making accusations. "No, I think I recognize you. I think you're one of them." It gets really hot. So Peter leaves and goes back out to stand in the shadows of the porches away from the fire, where he's not quite so conspicuous and quite so obvious. When he goes out there, there's another group of people out there and another servant girl after a while. And so we've had several minutes pass. We don't know how many minutes, but several minutes passed. And another servant girl begins to make accusations. And again, the other bystanders support her in her allegations and her accusations and keep charging him that, keep alleging that he's one of the disciples. And each time he deflects it and says, "No, you're wrong. That's not true." Eventually, it gets too cold. So he goes back to the fire, and he's back in the middle of the courtyard at the fire again. And this time a man, hearing his accent, says, "You're one of them. You've got to be. I can tell by the way you're talking." He had a Galilean accent. "I can tell by the way you're talking." Again, other people pile up and start accusing him. And Peter swears that he doesn't know Jesus. At which point, interestingly, and Luke is the only one that tells us this, Jesus is apparently being led from Caiaphas's house, maybe to Annas's house. I don't remember the chronology here. Either to go to Pilate or to go to Annas, the other Caiaphas's father-in-law, for his interrogation by Annas. And as he's being led outside, Peter turns, looks at Jesus, and the cock crows the second time. I forgot to tell you, while he was out in the porches, after his denial there, the cock crowed the first time. And then he makes eye contact with Jesus after having, for the third time, denied that he knew him, and the cock crows a second time. Peter remembers Jesus' words, "Before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times this evening." And then he runs out and he weeps bitterly when he comes to the realization of what he's done. Now, in reconciling these gospel accounts, it's crucial to understand what it is that Jesus is predicting. Sometimes the so-called lack of harmony or irreconcilable differences is that one gospel account says, "Before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times." Another one just says, "Before the cock crows, you will deny me three times." There's one well-known harmonization that has him deny Jesus six times, three before the cock crowed, and three more before he denied him a second time. That doesn't work, I don't think. He denies him three times, as long as we understand what a time is. Now, I want to talk about that in a second. What some of the gospel writers are saying, what's the significance of the cock crowing? The significance of the cock crowing is just, it's a way of saying, before dawn breaks, before we go so long, before we even get to the next day, you're going to deny three times that you know me. It's just that one of the gospel accounts includes the important detail that before the cock actually crows the second time, indicating the dawn of the new day, you're going to deny me three times. And why is that significant? The reason that's significant is, notice that Peter had denied him twice. The cock crowed. So the prediction is coming to pass, just as Jesus had said. You would think that at that point, Peter would have come to his senses and would have run out and wept bitterly or something like that. But he has still one more denial in him before he gets it, before he really understands what he's done. So this is a serious denial. He's been warned. He's been warned again by the cock crowing once, and he still is prepared to deny him. The crucial thing to recognize is that what Jesus is predicting is not that Peter is going to make three statements of denial of Jesus, but he's going to deny him on three distinct and independent occasions. I forgot to mention, I think it's John tells us that his return to the fire in the courtyard is 1 hour later than his initially being there. So his first and third denial are 1 hour apart. So he's had time to reflect on what he's doing and what he's thinking. And yet he's still prepared to deny him. So, you know, whether you deny him three times or six times, if it's in a rapid fire interchange with people who are accusing you, what difference does it make whether it's three or six? You're just on the spot, you're on the defensive, and every time they try to hit you with an accusation, you counter their thrust. It's how many fights do you get in, not how many punches get punched at you, that is the issue. You see? So he's going to get in a fight three times before morning. It's the occasions of denial that Jesus is predicting, not the number of statements. Let me make the distinction this way. Imagine being an American in a foreign country and having this conversation. Person A, "You are an American." Yankee, "I am not." Person A, "Sure you are." Yankee, "No, I never have been, I never will be." Person A, "Then what about that American flag tattooed on your right arm?" Yankee, quickly covering the tattoo with his left hand. Oh, that don't mean nothing. Look, I was just on my way to get a Swiss flag tattooed on my left arm. I can have an American flag tattoo if I want to. It's a free country, isn't it? Person A, no, it's a military dictatorship. Yankee, that's right, I forgot. But still, I'm not an American. An hour later, two more people come up to the American and engage him in conversation. Person B, hey, you're an American, aren't you? Yankee, no. Person B, you've got to be. You talk like one. Yankee, he simply shakes his head vigorously in denial. Person C, if you're not an American, then why are you carrying three suitcases and a bowling ball toward the airport? You've got to be trying to leave the country before we kill you. Yankee, no, I'm just on my way to join the professional bowlers tour. This year, it is a round-the-world cruise, so you see, you've got it all wrong. I'm not an American. Person C, you liar, we don't have any bowling in this country. Yankee, wherever there are alleys and gutters, there will be bowling. I'm not an American. Now, I think if I counted, there's 7 or 8 or 9 statements that I'm not an American, statements of denial in that account, but there's only 2 occasions of denial. The first occasion is where he's denying it to the first person, and then an hour later, he confronts 2 people who have come attacking him, alleging that he's an American, and denies several times with respect, makes several statements that he's not an American in conjunction with that. But it's only 2 occasions upon which he's denying his national identity. That's the situation that we have with Peter. On 3 separate and distinct occasions, several minutes apart, giving him time to reflect on what he's doing. Nonetheless, on 3 separate occasions, he comes to the position of denying that he's a follower of Jesus. Okay, now what's the significance of him denying that he knew Jesus? I really think we're dealing here with, Jesus had said, Satan wants to sift you like wheat, Peter. He wants to find out whether you do or do not believe, whether you are or are not committed to me. If Peter were just being a coward here, it wouldn't have nearly the significance that I think it actually in fact does. I think what we're seeing here is Peter in the midst of an existential crisis. Jesus is arrested. He's in custody. He's gonna die. He's gonna be executed. And Peter is now in danger because of that. The question that's facing Peter is, do you want to define your life and your identity as a follower of this guy? Do you really want to do that? So when the slave girl comes along and says, you were with him, weren't you? When Peter denies it, I don't think he's denying history. I don't think he is doing that because he's seeking to deceive her. But why is he seeking to deceive her? I think the reasoning would go, well, if I acknowledge that I have been with him, it may imply that my identity is defined as a follower of him. And I don't know if I want to go there. I don't know if I want my life and my destiny to be defined as a disciple of Jesus. So don't characterize me that way. Don't think of me that way. I'm having second thoughts about that. I don't know whether I want to land there or not. And because of the uncertainty, he doesn't want anyone in that courtyard to peg him as a follower of Jesus. I'm not sure I'm being clear, but if you understand what I'm saying, he's not just lying. He's wavering in his commitment. He's wavering in his decision as to whether he wants his life and destiny to be defined by his following, being discipleship to Jesus. And 3 times, he's still, three times in the course of an hour, he's still not prepared to make that commitment. Then it's only after the rooster crows the second time and he realizes that his own teacher predicted that he would do this, and he realizes the failure of his faith, that something hits him, something strikes him, And he realizes the very thing I want to be, I have not been. And something clicked then. And he weeps because he does want to be a disciple of Jesus, and yet he has not been clear and forthright and straightforward about that with these people. The reason I make that distinction is that I don't think it's always wrong to deceive people who are out to harm you just for the sake of deceiving people. I mean, in a way, Jesus has been doing that. Jesus has been going in hiding every night so that the authorities don't catch him. Well, what, does he not trust God? Is that fear taking over and canceling out and nullifying his faith? No, I don't think so. There's nothing wrong with protecting yourself just for the sake of protecting yourself. I don't think that's what Peter's doing. Peter is not just deceiving in order to protect himself. Peter is unclear who he is. And this event in his life was a very clarifying moment, because when he got through it and got out the other side of it, he now knew who he was and what he wanted to be. He wanted to be a follower of Jesus, no matter what, no matter what it might cost him. But in the middle of it, he's not able to say that yet. All of us will have these experiences in one way or the other in our lives. We will be sifted like wheat, maybe on more than one occasion. These existential crises that are going to raise the question in our mind, do you or do you not want to follow Jesus? And it's important that we, like Peter, eventually, one way or the other, come out deciding that we do want to be his disciple. Okay, that's what I was afraid of. I think I better stop for your questions and comments here, and then we'll come back and look at the events leading up to that next week.
I can see where Peter is experiencing the unfolding drama of Jesus' lack of power. It's just like everybody is manhandling him, dominating him, and he's starting to feel like in this life, this guy he's screwed, and I don't want to be part of that.
Yeah.
The existential crisis would be interesting if he was starting to doubt that Jesus was who he said he was, and he was more like other people who wanted him to make a big scene right now and, you know, take his place. But what if self-preservation was the wheat, was the chaff that the devil sifted? What if his fear of punishment or his fear of consequences for having been a follower of Jesus was in fact the chaff that the devil was looking for?
I think that's right. I think that is it.
And so instead of saying, well, Jesus isn't the guy I thought he was, but what's really going on here is I'm going to get hung if I stick.
Yeah, I don't think Peter's doubting that Jesus is the guy that he said he was. It's what he's doubting is whether that means enough to him for him to be attached to it. It's going to cost him. Is he willing to pay the cost? The price.
So piggybacking on that, you know, and the question of why did Peter deny him, in comparison with that question, I find the question of how he denied them and what was the sequence of events that occurred, you know, I mean, the how many times he denied him and in what order and at what response to who and how does that connect with the accounts in the gospel. I find those questions to be rather insignificant. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering why it's significant at all. For example, let's say the whole thing was caught on tape and the videotape surfaced in, you know, archaeological dig and we all got to watch it. And according to the videotape, he denied him once and then the cock crowed, and then he denied him again and the cock crowed. So that contradicts all the scenarios. So, I mean, if we saw that videotape, would we say, oh no, I guess I can't believe this account anymore? Or would we be distraught as a result of watching that? I mean, it seems to me that Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to make too much out of this point, but it seems to me that if you have four different accounts of the same event and they agree in their substantial, like in the essence of what they're teaching, but they disagree in the particulars of the events, that almost makes them more reliable in a way. Like if you have four witnesses of a car crash and they all report it in slightly different ways, then there's less reason to think that they're lying than if they were to all give exactly the same account.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, I don't know if I can give an adequate answer to that briefly, because to answer that, I'd want to give my whole defense for why I believe in biblical inerrancy. But that, it's not, maybe what I can say is this. I don't really care who it was that was accusing Peter and when. I mean, yeah, that doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is the spiritual significance, the spiritual dynamic, and what that can teach me, and what that why that's relevant to me. That's clearly why I want to study the account and understand the account. Having said that, if the biblical authors, though, don't get those kinds of details right, then it's a different kind of book than I think it is. And so we'd have to have a longer question about, well, why do I think it's a different kind of book, and what's the significance of it being a different kind of book? But to me, the Bible is unlike any other literature in all of human history. It's a very, very bizarre notion, a very bizarre concept. But we actually have a book that doesn't have any errors in it, such that I can trust it implicitly. Because I think it's that kind of book, if the evidence is right in front of me that you can trust it implicitly, but it can't even get its story straight about the details here, come on, Jack. You have a little integrity here. In order for me to be able to grant that kind of authority and have that kind of view of the Bible with an intellectual integrity, it's important for someone like me to know that what may on the surface appear to be irreconcilable errors are not in fact irreconcilable errors. If they are, that's fine. Then I go back to the drawing board on what kind of book this is and decide I have to rework how I relate to it and what I think about it and how I use it and how I glean teaching from it.
So the videotape would be very problematic then in your,
yes,
your view?
Yeah, for me that videotape would be problematic. Yeah. Not the videotape that I describe, but the videotape you describe would be problematic.
Hi. So just if you could add a little bit to your last answer. This is a little bit scary for me to ask this, because this is actually a question that I had way back at Gutenberg and I never got it answered. If you're looking at the Bible and it's inerrant in its facts, historical facts.
I'm having trouble hearing you, I'm sorry.
Oh, if it's infallible in its historical facts. but the reason you're reading it is to get the spiritual content of it. Mm-hmm. How would you read that differently from something like Ovid's Metamorphoses or something that's mythology?
Like who?
Ovid.
Oh, okay.
I know this. I should know this, but I don't.
Well, there are some people who believe in biblical inerrancy who will try to make the case that we have to have a Bible. We have to have an inerrant Bible, or our faith has no foundation. I don't think that's true. If God wanted to, the Spirit of God is capable and powerful enough to help me just bumble my way to truth. And if God so wanted us to find truth by bumbling around until we get there, then so be it. You know, that's fine. It just seems to me that Jesus himself taught us that God did this really incredibly strange thing. He gave us a book that has authority. He gave us writings that have authority. And not only that have authority, I make a distinction between ordinary authority and absolute authority. Ordinary authority is just when someone is teaching me or proclaiming something and they have greater experience than I do, I defer to their greater experience and I call that authority. So if someone is a Hegel scholar, I'm going to defer to their knowledge of Hegel over my measly, inadequate understanding of Hegel. So, but do I think they can't make a mistake about Hegel? No, I'm going to still be watching their reasoning and their thinking to see whether they have not been misled somehow by their own agenda or their own preconceived notions or something. I don't believe they are infallible. I just think that they've read a whole lot more than I have. So they are an authority or in that sense, and I grant them ordinary authority. The kind of authority Jesus seems to grant to the scripture, though, is what I would call absolute authority. That is to say, if the scripture says something, then you can know it's true. You don't have to watch out. You don't have to be checking them out. You don't have to be worried about whether the writers have been misled by their agenda or their preconceived notions or their faulty worldview or something. You can know that it's true. The way Jesus puts it explicitly in John, it's either 9 or 10, is the scripture says, and then he adds parenthetically, and the scripture cannot be broken. That's an incredibly telling statement, because what he's saying is, if the scripture says something that is true, you can trust implicitly that that it is true. Well, that's a very, very unusual and odd book, and I don't think God had to give us the Bible in order to save us, in order to bring us into wisdom and understanding. He could have done it in another way. But for whatever reason, God in his purposes has decided, I'm going to do this weird thing. I'm going to produce some writings through human beings throughout the course of history that I myself am going to supervene in the process to make sure that what they tell you is the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, and you can count on that. So I can go to other works and gain truth and gain wisdom and gain insight. I mean, any half-awake, intelligent human being can learn things from reality, and they can tell me about that, and they can pass that on to me, and I can read what they have to say with great profit. And that's great. But I don't believe them because they wrote it down. I believe them because I have independently considered and reflected on what they've taught me and said, I think they're right. I think that's true. That matches my experience as well. They've taught me, but I haven't submitted to them as an absolute authority. Whereas with respect to the scripture, my perspective on the scripture is that I'm prepared to submit to it as an absolute authority, which doesn't mean that I'm not prepared to reconsider whether it should have absolute authority. If that's why that videotape would totally shake my world. I mean, put that in perspective. Would rearrange my world slightly. that videotape would force me to rethink how I'm going to relate to the Bible, to these writings. And that's fine. I want to be on the side of truth. So if the videotape is proved by CSI to be authentic, then I will take that as a reason why I can't grant absolute authority to the scripture, and I'll have to go from there. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Deanna?
When you mentioned about John being his family with Caiaphas' mm-hmm. family, why isn't John on the hot seat? Ultimately, Peter is because of what God is doing in his life. But if I understood you correctly, John is there. They bring him in the courtyard. They're not questioning him. I mean, do they not have any awareness he hasn't been running around with Peter?
Yeah, we don't know.
We just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I was saying it. I would love to know more about that. Does the high priest know who John's been hanging out with? I mean, I don't know. But it must be that he's so familiar with the family and so on that they don't feel threatened by him, and it's not an issue for him. But Peter's a stranger. They don't know him. So they're wondering who is this guy? Weren't you with him? Weren't you? And in fact, I didn't mention this, but one of the guys who nails him is a relative of the guy whose ear Peter has just sliced off in the garden. And he says, I know who you are. So. Okay.
And how do we know that?
John, one of the gospel accounts tells us.
Okay. I think. And is John not Galilean? I mean, you mentioned that in one it talks about his specific accent.
Well, I think he is. Okay. It wouldn't be in. He probably has relatives in Jerusalem, but he grew up in Galilee, or at least as an adult, he's in Galilee. Maybe he didn't grow up in Galilee, but as an adult, he's in a fishing business with his father out of Capernaum. Is that what I mean? Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
One more.
I consider this thing of inerrancy, and what I find that reading the Bible is like a high school, that a lot of people never read Moby Dick. They read the Cliff Notes, and they can answer and get a good grade on the test. And a lot of people do the same with the Bible, is that they're not reading the Bible, they're reading the Cliff Notes or Barnes Notes or Calvin's commentaries, and everything is agreeing with these notes. And they're not really interacting with the Bible or what God's actually saying. And it has some interesting points. I've been reading some stuff from early church writings, second century, and their view of following Christ and what Christianity was about is completely different than most of what I see. So when you talk about this, taking the Bible as an absolute, I believe that is an absolute authority. But I don't think most people do. I think most people have references to their denominations or, as it says of the Jews, I mean, even the Pharisees held that it was inerrant and every jot and tittle is unchangeable. And yet it says through their traditions it made void the law of God. Yeah. So what kind of things can we do to check our blinders, our conditioning about what it says?
Well, I think listen to what you just said. I mean, it is come to an awareness of how powerful the paradigm that we bring to the Bible is. And most of us have been given the way to look at the Bible through the teaching of our tradition or our background or our denomination or whatever. And we just take it for granted. Understandably, we just take it for granted that... Well, that tradition wouldn't be saying it was so if they didn't get it from the Bible, so it must be what the Bible is saying. And I think we just need to be disabused of that notion and realize, no, every tradition needs to be critiqued and held accountable to what the Bible actually says, which means we need to be very, very diligent to read, study, understand, think intelligently about what the Bible is actually saying. That's crucial. I mean, next week we'll look at the passage where Jesus is warning the disciples to pray and pray that they not be led into temptation. We'll talk about what that means. But I was just thinking about, in a way, that whole scene is, I think, a metaphor for where we're headed in American culture. I think we are clueless about how bad it's going to get for us as believers. And it's very, very important that we become knowledgeable, literate in actually what the Bible really does say, not what our traditions teach us, but what the Bible actually really does say. And I think if we're not prepared, we're just going to be swept away like crazy by the onslaught that's coming somewhere downstream here. I couldn't say enough about how important I think it is that we begin to start interacting directly with our Bibles and know them and learn them and digest them and inculcate them, make them our own, so that we internalize everything that it teaches and everything that it says and the whole worldview of the Bible, that becomes internalized in us. Because I don't know if we can stand if we don't. So that's a very, very important important observation. Thank you. We'll finish this next week.